The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
We'll continue this morning with our examination of and practice of and work with the Lojong teachings from Tibetan Buddhism. The 7 points and 59 slogans that we've been working through for some time now. And today we will transition into the final point, point seven, which Norman Fisher presents to us as living with ease in a crazy world. And so I talked, seems like a long time ago, about post-meditation. In post-meditation, be a child of illusion. And the teachers that present these teachings to us say that this is now all post-meditation. How do we live our lives off the cushion? What do we bring to our entire lives and make our entire lives cognate with our practice and with our bodhisattva vows? And so I will look at the first two of these and maybe or maybe not mention the third one. And the first is number 39, keep a single intention. And number 40 is correct all wrongs with one intention. And then maybe 41, but I won't even mention it now. So intention is what I'm going to talk about. And yesterday evening, we had some technical difficulties. We had a recorder failure, which was mechanical error. And then we had a bookmark error, which was what Artenzo calls operator error. But now I have my bookmark back where it should have been. And so I wanna make a transition from last night when we talked about not making gods into demons into today by reading that beautiful and haunting and kind of scary quotation from Shantideva, from his Way of the Bodhisattva. All the harm with which this world is rife, all fear and suffering that there is, clinging to the eye has caused it. What am I to do with this great demon? What are we to do with this great demon of the self? And one thing that we can do is to hold to one intention. And Tralag Kyapgan Rinpoche calls 39, all spiritual practices should be done with one intention. And this can be expanded to all of our actions should be done with one intention. And so what is this intention? This intention can be seen in two different angles. And one angle is to let this self go as much as we can. And the other angle is to dedicate ourselves to the benefit of all beings. And this is the same intention. Tralag says, if we examine our minds closely, we'll see that our thoughts, speech, and actions are almost entirely motivated by egoistic obsessions. We need to develop the same single-mindedness in our spiritual practice, Sanskrit yoga, in our yoga, by taking bodhicitta as the object of our attention. And he says, you know, we can't just beat up on the self. We can't take a crowbar to it and beat it into submission. But he says, but if we deliberately bring kindness, sensitivity, and gentleness into our thoughts, speech, and actions, we'll start to experience a natural diminution of our self-obsessive tendencies. And this is why making our intention one of serving all beings, of kindness and generosity to all beings, is the same as making our intention one of softening, of turning this demon too into a bodhisattva protector, as Padmasambhava and other legendary heroes of the conversion of Tibet into Buddhism tamed the local demons and made them bodhisattva protectors. So no, we don't get to free ourselves of the karmic self. Sorry, if that was your intention, you came to the wrong zendo. We will carry that karmic self with us all the way along our journey. And we don't need to to feed it. We can let it slim down a little. We can let that big demonic ego lose some of its pounds and maybe even get a little bit weakly. We don't mind that. It won't die. But we can take a little of the spirit out of it, as one might a horse that was just too spirited. So just feed it less. And we know what the self eats. It eats poisons. It eats the three poisons of greed, anger, and ignorance. It eats clinging and aversion and delusive certainty. And so we work at that level, at the level of noticing our aversion and our clinging and our false certainty. And we work at this level of kindness to others and generosity to others and putting others before the self as much as we can. And so we bring this one intention to our entire lives. And, you know, in common sense, the common sense world, we don't actually think much of intentions, do we? And we use expressions like, I can hear my mom saying this, so much for good intentions. Well, I was going to take the garbage out. So much for good intentions, Al. So, so much for good intentions. And yet, intention, it can be so powerful. It can be so powerful in our spiritual lives. It can be powerful in other endeavors too. And I'm going to talk about one for the last time, maybe, that I love to talk about, which is involves walking a path and involves a great dedication. And this is another path I share with our Tenzo, which is walking the Appalachian Trail. And every distance hiker pretty much knows this. There's something that we call trail magic. And it's not the organized, fake trail magic that, you know, where somebody sets up a weenie roast and a couple of cases of beer at a trail crossing. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Happy to have my dog and beer with the best of them. But this really is more like magic. And when you talk to people on the trail, when you've been on the trail for a while, you hear lots of stories like this, and nobody knows how to explain them. And I'll just give you very briefly an example of how this happened to me. How just the only thing in the universe you need appears, and you don't know how it's even possible that it did. And so on one hike through the Shenandoah National Park, and then into West Virginia, I think it was like an 8 or 9 day hike, maybe 9 days, very first morning. Full morning of the full day, I had a mishap, operator error again with my stove canister, and all the gas, all the propane and butane just went out like a balloon deflating, and I had, my ultralight self had said, just bring one canister, you only need one for 9 days, and so I had zero canisters now, and I had no way to cook all the food that I brought, and I think I had 9 days of food with me. And I had 5 days of food, and then 4 I was going to pick up. And now, what was I going to do? And there were these waysides that had just opened up because it was spring along the Shenandoah, the highway that goes through there. Is it the Blue Ridge or is it the other one? Anyway, it's continuous with the Blue Ridge. And so I darted into the one that was on the map for that day. They had every gas canister you could imagine. They had them for boats. They had them for, you know, the big grills you have in your backyard. They had them for obscure European stoves that nobody even owned anymore. But they did not have the standard backpacker canister that I needed. And so, I bought some cheese and some crackers, and I thought, I'll just eat what I don't have to cook for maybe 9 days, I don't know. Until one of these waysides comes through, or I just give up. And so, I don't know, maybe I did 60 miles or 70 miles that day. I came to a shelter, and these shelters are just three-sided, open in front, totally simple, no electricity, no running water, making water from a stream or a spring, just big, like an empty garage with the garage door open, nothing in it, maybe some bunks built in, maybe not. And I walk into this shelter. I've stayed in hundreds of shelters or passed through them or had lunch in them, hundreds and hundreds. And for the only time in all those hundreds of shelters, and I can't explain this, I walked in and there on a shelf was a canister of this gas I needed, exactly the gas I needed. And I went to pick it up expecting to find it empty, and someone had just left their trash, and I picked it up and it was entirely full. And there was another one next to it that was about a third full. So I don't know how that happened. And yet there it was. So I think those of us that hike the trail feel this has something to do with our intention. Our intention to hike the trail brings this out. And our intention to practice this way together brings something out. The universe will sometimes come to meet our intention. And so we hold to this one intention to let the ego get softer, and to both do that partly to be of greater service to all beings, and by showing kindness, by putting ourselves second, by all these little acts that by themselves maybe don't change the world, but additively they do make a huge difference. All of these acts in turn soften the ego. And so we try to bring this intention to all the areas of life that we can. And so one way that we do this is by studying and practicing the precepts. And so we read the 10 precepts together. And you may have noticed that when we recite the 10 precepts before we do that, we take refuge. And here we are, yet again, rediscovering what we learned about the Lojong training, that when we do the refuges, we start with absolute bodhicitta, with absolute compassion. All beings are Buddha, right? And the Sangha, the interdependence of all beings. We start with this, and then we narrow into the various ways that we can live in the world, causing less harm, doing more kindness, causing less harm to ourselves as well as to others. And the precepts are wonderful guidelines for putting this one intention into many forms. And so I imagine, you know, light going through, a white light going through a prism and breaking up into different colored lights. And that's how I'm feeling about the precepts right now, with the light of that one intention now taking all these different forms. And some of them, of course, of the precepts are some as the same as some of the slogans we study together. So don't speak ill about other people. Don't lie. You know, things. Some of them are universal teachings. Some of them not so much. You know, and we take them all to heart. And then another way that we can take this white light of intention and let it break into different colors is through devices like Robert Aitken's Vows for Daily Life. And Norman Fisher talks about maybe coming up with little vows or slogans of your own, so for each part of your day. I will say that doesn't work for me. For me, it's just a little, I don't know, too mechanistic. And maybe it's because I grew up as a child saying grace before meals and saying prayers before bedtime, and they didn't seem to do much good. And so the rote stuff, I guess saying things by rote, something that I don't get a lot from, but you may. And so please don't base your practice on what works for me. Base your practice on what you know works for you. And maybe little gathas like this, little vows, will really help you maintain your practice. For me, it's more of a constant reminder of what kind of a person I really want to be, and how I want to engage with the world. And sometimes, now this will sound just as hokey, but That's anything Robert Aiken could say. But I've sometimes, I've picked up on that WWJD, what would Jesus do, that you see on bumper stickers sometimes. And so every once in a while when I don't want to do something, so I'll be, I'll wake up with the one I love at her house, and she's had to rush off to work because she has to start work before I do. And I've got, you know, if I leave now, I'm going to have this nice, leisurely drive to work and a little extra time and maybe get an extra coffee. If I leave in 10 to 15 minutes, maybe not so much. And I look and there's a bunch of dishes in the sink. And so, and guess what I want to do? Yeah, right. I want to start the car. And so what I say to myself is, what does the Bodhisattva do? So that's my version of it. What does the Bodhisattva do? And then I know instantly. And I don't even have to think about it. And I just walk over and I turn the water on and start doing the dishes. And it ends up taking 5 minutes. And then I think, oh, she'll be happy when she comes home. Or she won't even notice it. And either way, you know, it's great. It's great I did this. And after a while, I don't even have to say, what would the Bodhisattva do? I just see them and it's like, okay, Alan, come on. And there I am, and the water goes on. And if she is listening to this on tape, no, I don't do it every time. So you don't have to out me to the group. But I try to do it enough times that it makes a difference. And really, the difference it's making, I think, I mean, she can come home and wash the dishes. She's a big girl. But she raised three kids. But the difference it's making is in me. Maybe I'm going to be just a little bit less self-oriented for the rest of the day. I said maybe I would talk a little bit about this one, begin at the beginning, end of the end. You know, begin the day with some expression of this one intention. For me, part of that, I talked to a lot of people in Doksan at my practice group about what's your daily practice like? Do you have a daily practice? When do you sit? And I often suggest try sitting early in the morning, because for me, that's like setting that intention for the day. I find it very, very valuable for myself to sit zazen before I leave the house. And it doesn't have to be before I have coffee. It doesn't have to be, you know, before I've gotten dressed or taken my shower. But it should be before I leave. I find that very, very valuable, because then that's going to help establish my intention for the entire day. And now I want to talk a little bit about this second one that comes out of keep a single intention, which is correct all wrongs with one intention. So what does that mean? And let's see what our friend and guide Norman Fisher says about this. He says here's what Trollig says. All corrections are made in one way. Maintaining the Lojong spirit of bodhicitta in the face of adversity is integral to the practice of mind training. So we don't let up when things get tough. We don't relax. Actually, our intention is more important than ever. And what our Zen friend Norman Fisher says, he says, correct all wrongs with one intention means that when we notice inevitably that we are not being so generous or so kind or so open-hearted, I talked about that last night, when we notice that we're not being so generous or so kind or so open-hearted, that our activity has not been dedicated in our hearts altruistically, that instead we've completely lost track of all our good intentions and have become, as if half asleep, narrow, grim, and desperate. That there's that demon self. That's what he looks like. That's what she looks like. Narrow, grim, and desperate. We should take a breath right there at the moment of noticing this. With that breath, we forgive ourselves. So this is not, again, don't take the crowbar to the self. Oops, there I go again. Sorry. And go on. We reset the dial with one intention. Our purpose is to be of some benefit to others, to dedicate ourselves to others. So this is our wake-up call. Just turn again. Take that moment. There it goes. There's that self again. And then instantly, you know, make the demon a bodhisattva, protector of the Dharma. Make the demon into a godling, and not the god into a demon. So this is the invitation. And this is something that is always available to us. And then I want to say one last thing, which is, in Zen, our core practice is Zazen. And we've been doing a lot of Zazen at this retreat. And I've just advocated, at least considering starting every day with Zazen. Wonderful way to begin your day. And if there's a day I'm going to be sitting with my practice group in the evening, I might not sit for as long in the morning. I still try to sit some in the morning for that benefit. And what does Zazen have to do with this one intention? It seems that when we're sitting on the cushion, how are we showing kindness to all beings? How are we reaching out with the thousand arms of Avalokiteshvara and reaching out to the suffering of the world? And so let me say something about how that works for me. First, I want to say we don't know what we're doing for all beings when we sit on the cushion. We don't know what effect is going to ripple out just from this act of sitting still and unmoving and really being with whatever arises, really working with turning towards and not turning away, really not distracting ourselves by scratching or moving, let alone getting up for that water or to make that note or to check that email that we really want to do sometimes on the cushion. Really working with that slow drip, very patient study of the mind, learning our mind's ways, learning something about how really broad and wide the mind can be, letting our breathing expand until it's not just us, a little isolated self breathing, but the universe is breathing us. Engaging in all those variations on our Zazen practice that again soften the separate self, our illusion of separation, and maybe enable us to do what the Bodhisattva would do more spontaneously and more effectively, we say more skillfully, because there are unskillful ways to help people, to try to help people, and there are skillful ways. Hard to know. No one can set us out rules to know the difference. Precepts are great guidelines. No rules. It has to come from the heart. And so we have to let our hearts expand, and we have to let ourselves know the heart. And Zazen is our way, our primary way of doing that. And Zazen is, I believe, you know, a kind of direct assault on the three poisons in that way. The exercise guided by the intention to just sit still and unmoving. Just this exercise of staying on the cushion, staying with the breath, seeing what comes up, staying with what comes up for as long as it's there, letting it go when it's ready to go. Just that long years and years and years of this, or months and months, or days and days, wherever you are in your practice. Every time you sit on the cushion, this is a chance to be a little bit less clingy. A little bit less aversive, a little bit less falsely certain that you know, that you know what's what, you know what the self is, what the world is, that you weren't born yesterday. Well, on the cushion, maybe you can be born right now. Let the concepts go. Let all your ideas, including all your ideas about Zen, all your ideas about Buddhism, let them go. See what happens. So let's take a few breaths to do that, and then we will have our Dharma dialogue. So now as we go into our Dharma dialogue, let me remind you that this is being recorded, and we're always happy to pause the recorder if anyone would like to speak without being recorded. And let's start by going around and saying our names. So I'm Alan.
I'm Carol. Jenny.
Judith.
Susan.
David.
Ray.
Eric.
David.
Melissa.
So what comes up for you, my friends?
I had that exact same trail man.
Yeah, please tell us.
I was out of gas, the butane stove, maybe like 4 days from a town or something, and I stopped at a shelter intending to eat my instant oatmeal cold, and under the shelter was a gas canister about a quarter full, and got me right to town.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah, and have you ever seen one before or since?
Not yet.
Yeah. So
it makes me wonder if there's somebody going up the trail and down the trail putting little gas canisters.
Well, they don't do it very often because, you know, we only see them that one time.
You need them.
Right. So if they are, they somehow know exactly when someone is going to meet them.
And it made me think of Mark Vonnegut, son of Kurt, in his book Eden Express. He was talking about grace. He called that grace, and being addicted to grace, and seeing it everywhere all the time.
Being addicted to grace.
Ray.
Love your talk. And this mountain magic got me thinking that it seems to me that this magic is ever present. Just don't notice it. And at times it's you know more noticeable, like you know I get into my car and it starts. I open my mouth and words come out. And the body moves, you know. I want to get up to walk in and the body cooperates. So it's continuously manifesting, and oftentimes out of my awareness. But yeah, when my need is greatest, then I'm much more on the lookout for us, and then I'm much more aware of being met. But I've always been met, you know, in one way or another, just not aware of it.
You make me recall the phrase we used a little while back from Yasutani Roshi, that bodhisattvas arise from the cracks in the earth as they're needed. And there's Jung has this theory of synchronicity, that everything is always present, but we only notice things when we need to notice them. So we're like surrounded by benevolence, but it's only when we're kind of falling apart and then we notice, you know. But so actually going back to the canisters, they could be there all the time, but when we need them, there they are, right? And so it's not even that magical if you think about it that way, you know. There's this so it's like if you've just broken up with somebody, all you see are couples. And if you're trying to buy a new car, all you see are cars. Right, it's kind of like, so the view, there's billions of bits of information coming at us all the time, but the mind focuses on what's needed, and then the need's met. You know, so it's kind of like, I think you're pointing to some similar way of looking at that. Everything is abundant, and then we can receive this abundance. Yeah, does that kind of go along with what you're saying?
Yeah.
I love what you said, Ray, and it reminded me, and you know, I was talking about the beginning of the day, and one thing that I haven't really tried to cultivate as a practice, but it just started kind of happening, is when I wake up in the morning, you know, I often start with this feeling of how grateful I am that I'm alive, and that you know, I'm in this human body still, this precious human body, and I have another day. And when I put my feet on the floor, I often feel grateful that when I stand up, the floor holds me up. It's just this, you know, it's just this way of starting the day. And then, as you say, this just carries through all through the day. Yeah. Every time I try to breathe, there's air. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Ray.
It reminds me too of, Reb Anderson talks a lot about call and response, you know, calling out and responding and, he says it's always going on, but there are actually four, you can make a grid of four cell matrix, that usually we're not aware of calling out and we're not aware of the response. You know, I just get up and start walking. Sometimes we're aware of calling out, but we're not aware of the response. You know, how come life isn't giving me what I want? Sometimes we're not aware of calling out, but we are aware of the response. You know, the world just appears to us. And sometimes we're conscious of needing a fuel canister, and the fuel canister appears. So conscious of the call and the response. But, you know, in Zen we talk so much, this life is call and response. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the universe is always there. Mm-hmm. Always, always. Yeah.
David.
Thank you for your talk. I can experience the mop magic is really easy. Like when I'm 40 minutes of work practice is really great this morning. I can, like, looking out the window and, you know, the sun shining on the soul and the people walking by and the cop traffic. And it's like, yeah, everything's shining in its own light. And,
yeah.
You know, when all things shine with the same light, I can really feel that and feel like the kindness of the people I'm working with, Ray and Susan. But then I've been like trying to really work with what Norman Fisher said about like practicing when you're distracted. Mm-hmm. It's not quite there. Those are like the moments where like I just lose my bearings and it just like overwhelms me and then I just feel like I can't do it, you know? So like last night I'm trying to like get my work completed and I had a client who needed to ride to the store, the service station to pick up a food because he didn't have. He really didn't feel like cooking. Then he just ended up getting there. He gets a sandwich. It's like overpriced. He says that to himself. And so I just felt like it's kind of like, I think that the thing that deflates me more than anything is like a feeling of futility. So I guess this is like kind of, I'm holding like, trying to practice during those moments. And that's like somehow kind of the notion that Fisher talks about too, about like, doing it for its own sake, not expecting some sort of outcome here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's really hard when the rubber hits the road and it's easy to experience here.
And you know, the fact that you're noticing all this, right? You say, yeah, I'm trying to do this practice when I'm distracted and it's really hard, but somehow you're noticing that you're getting distracted and that it's really hard. And that's 90% of it, right? That what we do when we catch ourselves being distracted is catch ourselves being distracted. And that's it, you know? And it's like noticing that the self is over asserting itself again. Mm-hmm. And then you notice that. And that's, you know, so the noticing, it is so much of it that to me this sounds way more hopeful than maybe you meant it to sound. I'm thinking, wow, yeah, you're on the right track. Yeah, there you go. So maybe we should not be too hard on ourselves and just even honor the very noticing that comes up when we think that we're falling short. Mm-hmm.
Well, and here's the real cool thing. I think it's 100% of it is the noticing, right? I heard the kind of delight in what you were describing, that, you know, I'm really just noticing that I'm not noticing. And that's all of practice to me. So, you know, it can sound very operational and instrumental. All I have to do is make sure to remember to feel grateful, or make sure to remember to bring my attention to this, or, you know, but really not remembering is also it 100%. You know, the being in despair is it. Mm-hmm. Being frustrated is it. It's really good news. It's a very positive thing. Mm-hmm. That at our lowest point, you know, when Yunmin says everything has its own light, you were quoting from that. Mm-hmm. Before he says that, he says it's dark, or maybe after he says this, it's dark, dark. Right? It's not just about the light. It's dark. So it's completely 100%. Sometimes for us, we wake up in the morning and we don't feel grateful, and we think, uh-oh, got to generate my gratitude. Mm-hmm. Natural arising of gratitude, I think, comes when we don't make an effort to be grateful. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's like the Bodhisattva, the response of the universe. It's kind of it's a get out of jail free card in a way. Get out of suffering free card. That if you're suffering, you know, what's the name of the woman who says that awareness is its own action? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So it really is. And then if you're not being aware, that's it too. Like we're already Buddhas. Mm-hmm. So, and then we help each other remember, oh, the world is full of light. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Alan reminds us. I keep thinking, Al? I never think of you as Al.
Yeah, this is a closely guarded secret.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, don't put it on the internet or anything.
It's now on the internet. I kind of want to call you senior Dharma teacher Al.
Right, and then I'll think that you're my mom and you really don't want me to think.
That's so great. But as Al was saying, you know, here it is, all the time. And the canister was waiting for us. Mm-hmm. I won't ever do that again. At least I hope not.
Are there things coming up for anyone?
Yeah. Just that remind me of Dogen has got a little, what do you call it, fascinating, a little thing. And when he talks about what happens with the magic is the small miracles. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the big miracles are the five senses, you know, the six senses continuously manifesting. Mm-hmm. That's the big miracles.
Yeah.
And we sort of get hooked with the small miracles sometimes. But you know.
Right.
The big miracles are continuously manifesting.
Yeah. I kind of think of the box and lid.
Yeah.
With what Ray's talking about, like, yeah, the way everything
fits together.
Works.
Well, it makes me think, too, of the small miracles, having this cold. That sitting in zazen, normally I wouldn't notice it. I'd just be sick. There'd be a box around it. But, the nostrils have cleared completely. Mm-hmm. And then a few minutes later, oh, the left one's stuffy. But the right one's still clear. And, you know, it's just ongoing. And I think it's like this all the time. And we just don't notice because we're living in our concepts instead of in the actual matter of things flowing. Yeah, so hiking the trail, doing zazen, these are ways that we sink down into the moment-to-moment reality.
Well, I want to say, too, there's such a fine line here that we're skirting around this with intention and willpower, that it feels like this intention you were speaking about, Alan, is so important that, for me, that it's aligning with something that is deeply true for us, that is deeper than self-improvement. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned that service to others. Yeah. And that when we touch that deeper intention, and, you know, you mentioned the crowbar, mm-hmm. you know, that's to how do we deal with these people that we are? You know, we just want to fix them, right? I just want to fix myself so I'm not stuck in whatever I'm stuck in. And this, the paradoxical teaching of Zen is that it is the poison itself, it is the ego itself that is a manifestation of Buddha nature. We don't want that one to be running the show, as you say, because that's quite a problem. But in one of the passages, it also mentioned that how important kindness is. And I think a lot of this Lojong, I mean, this training in compassion, Norman Fisher says again and again, to bring this kindness to whatever arises in us. Like, it's so easy to think of compassion. I want to be compassionate with those other people. And it's so hard to be compassionate with the one we are or with the state we're in. You know, how do we open our heart? So when the selfishness comes up, very difficult to meet it without aggression. As you say, you know, the crowbar is so handy. You know, I'm just going to, if I hit the ego enough, maybe it will get tired, but it just loves it. Just gets stronger and stronger. Mm. So this is some kind of fundamental allowing things to be, not working, not fixing, not getting rid of anything. But hanging out enough to see into the true nature of it. And then the very problem is the great resource. So if you've got a great demon ego, great. Yeah, good for you. You need that. That energy is life, is not separate. You know, Melissa, I love how you say over and over again, this is included, and this is included. How about this? Oh, yeah, that's included too. You know, that's the great mystery of this practice. And so the intention to head into that mystery in service of awakening, and this awakening that is not just for me, is not just for other people, but is beyond that.
If I could spin onto that a little bit too, that's something that came up for me as you were speaking, David, is that, you know, the word kindness is cognate with the word kin, and you know, and we use words like humankind, you know, and, you know, Adam named the animals each in its kind, you know, this is the alignment. Our kindness comes from being from our humanity, and so it's not like we're imposing something alien on this feisty, you know, animal. It's we're allowing ourselves to be in alignment with our kind, with us as one of our kin, you know, with what we are. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, two things. It sort of relates to, you know. One thing I want to mention is like, oh, I'm like curious. I don't know the box and lid thing because I wasn't here, but, you know, because she mentioned box and lid.
Oh, it's actually a saying. In saying. Okay. It's how things fit together. Like absolute a box and the absolute and the relative.
Oh, I got you. Okay, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And the other thing that was coming up that seems relevant to what we just talked about here is... you brought up the horse, the wild horse, and that you don't want to feed it. And I have a background with horses way long ago, you know, and it's like, and so I struggled with that idea. What do you mean, not feeding the horse? You know, and so what fit for me better was kind of kindness toward the horse, getting it used to, getting it used to caring for it well, you know? Yeah. And, because we all have that wildness.
Yeah, you know, so that's right.
you know, be with that in them.
Well, and that goes to what David was just saying, right? That the thing that we think is a problem is it contains the gift that we've been looking for. That wildness.
Every problem was once a solution.
Yeah.
Somebody said,
yeah. But the wildness, so yeah. Right? Doesn't it touch your heart? Just you are wild, wild creature. Yeah. And there is, you know, as David was saying, this is a very subtle thing we're talking about. So we keep dancing to either side of it. And intention brings up that problem because it sounds like setting a goal, and it actually isn't. It's aiming ourselves in a certain direction and then being in resonance with the kindness, the being with in alignment with the fitting together, like the locksmith's lid. And so here's the thing we get to deal with. And right, you know, we don't want to starve out any part of the Buddha nature. And this is the idea, you know, sometimes in self-help manuals they say, feed what's good and starve what's bad. But really what we're doing is saying, what is the nourishment that's needed in this moment? Yeah, yeah. It's so easy to go black and white. And we love to do that. And luckily, we don't have that much control. If any.
Well, let's sit for another few moments.